Welcome, everyone, to the Writers Advisory Council for June. I'm going to call this meeting to order and bring us straight into our public comment period. John, do we have anybody signed up?
First person up is Chris Barnes.
Mr. Barnes.
Hi, I'm Chris Barnes. You all know me, but I'm also known as Fix WMATA. So tonight I want to talk about communications. We've seen many ways WMATA tracks its services through metrics, including bus and rail performance, elevator and escalator performance, etc. But what I've never seen asked by this council or otherwise is how WMATA determines its communications are being successful. We're now 2 years into a seemingly non-ending rebuilding, and the Metro Forward campaign lays in ruins. Signs are barely there and don't get updated. The website is mostly useless, and there are no updates on what was done, when service was impacted, or how the work relates to the overall rebuilding effort. The Twitter account for Metro Forward hasn't tweeted since May 3rd, many weekends of track work ago. There are 51 staff positions for communications and marketing, yet riders are left in the dark and a heavily invested campaign left to rot. If WMATA isn't going to track their success with communication to riders, I ask the RAC to push for better results. Thank you.
Thank you. Anyone else signed up for public comment?
All right, I wrote this down so I won't cuss or use acronyms so WMATA doesn't block me from Twitter. Metro has a very deep level of mistrust from the ridership. By the way, we are riders, not customers. I lay that blame on the PR department and squarely on the shoulders of Dan Stutzel. I, in fact, will not believe he or what they have to say when the system is in a delay mode, fire mode. We're not letting you out of this train mode or whatever mode they're in. I call on the question his remarks on Monday the 3rd that were printed in the Post on the 4th. Right here. The headline is Trouble on All Metro Rail Lines. There was also report of a, quote, down track circuit on the Green Line outside Southern Avenue stop, something Stutzel called a, quote, fairly routine issue. Crews reset the circuit and the two trains were each delayed 10 minutes, he said. Later in the article, there have been delays worth noting on the red and orange lines, he said in an email. The other issues were a minor rigmarole of any AM commute. I take you back to the NTSB report released on July 27, 2010, that blamed a faulty track circuit, part of the automatic train control system, for causing the crash. I'm asking this board to ask him, what does he mean by routine when the NTSB says it was a cause of a crash that murdered 9 people? What does he mean by routine and rigmarole? If I was a rider, I'd be very concerned about this. Can I have one more minute? My second point is two quotes off of Twitter from this past month. And I'd like you to take down these quotes and take them to the WMATA board, and maybe we'll get a response from them this time and not be ignored by them. The first quote is from a man on a camel's hump, and he said, the WMATA system is disintegrating. Just be happy they haven't mass murdered the passengers lately. And the second one struck a nerve with me. She's a Red Line rider, and she, this is during the fire they had in Silver Spring. Her name is Snazzy Redhead, and her first name's Alexandria. I am legitimately convinced I'm going to die on the Red Line. What is WMATA going to do when they actually do hurt or kill people? Ask the board what they think of that. Ask them if any other transit agency has people worried about being killed in the past month.
Thank you. Anyone else signed up for public comment?
No one else signed up.
Okay. Thank you very much. We'll move to approval of the agenda and past meeting minutes by unanimous consent. Any objections there? Seeing none. We'll move directly to our presentation on off-board smart trip loading. And we welcome Jim Buongiorno from the Office of the Treasury here at Metro.
Good evening. It's a pleasure to be here. John, are we okay? My presentation will be up on the big screen momentarily. While we're waiting for that to come up, I've been asked to lead a project to install off-board loading devices at selected bus stops through the system. What you see on this opening slide is gives you an idea of some of the devices that we're considering. And we'll talk about that a bit more, but just to give you a general idea, the one on the left is actually a solar-powered device similar to the parking pay stations you might be familiar with around the district. The one in the middle is more of a traditional ticket vending machine type of device. It's conventionally powered. And the question mark is all of the other devices that are out there from other organizations that we might be considering. John, next slide. So what we want to talk about tonight would be the project goals. I've got some pictures to show you to give you kind of a concept of how this might work. We'll go through the smart trip off-board loading devices, what the requirements are, what the vendor marketplace looks like, how many we're considering purchasing, and where we might install them, and then talk a little bit about how you folks might be able to help us with your experience and feedback. And you all have your backs to the screen. Is that it? Do we need to? Are you looking? Oh, okay. I just want to make sure. Okay. didn't want to be impolite. All right, John, next slide, please. Okay, so the basic issue we're concerned is that, and as the pictures illustrate, we have folks that add value with the fare box on a bus, and while that's certainly a legitimate thing to do, the concern is that increases the dwell time for the buses. If you are a regular bus rider, you know that an experienced person could do it in a few seconds. An inexperienced person, I've seen as high as 30 seconds to complete one of those transactions, and if you have a line of people out the door, it's raining or snowing or what have you, that can be inconvenient and also delays the bus in terms of its ability to complete the schedule. Based on our farebox data, we know that on average, 1 in 14 transactions at the farebox are, in fact, add value sales transactions. And on the routes that have the more, some routes are as high as 1 in 7 passengers that are doing it. Next slide, please. So our goal, of course, is to utilize these off-board devices at bus stops in the hopes that the riders will take advantage of that and add value to their smart trip cards before the bus arrives so that we can improve on-time performance. That's one of the goals. Yet another goal is to improve customer convenience by making the ability to add value more accessible to riders, especially in areas that are underserved by retailers. You can go to a CVS or a Giant, for example, to add value. You can go to a rail station to add value, but there are areas of the district and well, the communities that we serve where that's not as convenient to do. So to kind of give you an idea, this is a poor man's artist rendition, if you will, but it gives you some idea of scale. We have, for example, a solar-powered device at Minnesota Avenue and Benning Road, which happens to be one of the locations that has the highest number of add value transactions. And as you can see, we probably would not stick it right where we have it in this picture. This is just to give you an idea of, if you will, fit and comparison to John. If you could do the next slide. what it would look like if we had a ticket vending machine there. So some of the challenges we have around these locations will be trying to go with a smaller footprint as we can, so we still leave room for make it accessible or make the buses accessible, and yet at the same time make it convenient to where the stop is so that people will feel comfortable loading value to their smart trip cards before the bus arrives. John, if you want to go to the next slide, this is more of a downtown location. In fact, this is right around the corner. And again, you can see the potential challenges we face in terms of having these devices out there. Next slide, John. And that gives you the idea of what a ticket vending machine style device would look. John? Okay, so with that visual in mind, we've got, what are we after? Again, we're after improving or allowing off-board, allowing you to add value to your smart trip cards off-board. And we would accept all smart trip cards that Vermont accepts, so that would be the smart trip and the charm card. We need to update our back-end systems so that we can feed all that information into your accounts as you're adding values, just as you would in a rail station, for example. The payment forms that we're looking for are, we want to be able to take bills, coins, debit and credit, but we would not give change, and there'd be no escrow. And escrow means there wouldn't be a cancel button, so that if you just changed your mind at the last minute, we wouldn't spit the money back out at you. When that's essentially mimicking what the fare box does, and that's also from a consideration from a cost perspective, it becomes a lot much more. It becomes much more expensive if we had change in the machines, because we'd have to have we'd have to make trips to the machines more often to service them if that were the case, and we're trying to balance that benefit against the cost of doing that. We talked about the streetscape. It has to be attractive with a reasonable footprint. That's a requirement. Durability needs to work under all DC weather conditions. And in fact, that's part of the reason why we're looking at vendors that have experience with parking pay stations, since they have plenty of experience having their devices out in the environment, not only from a weather perspective, but also for the next item, from a security perspective. Obviously, they have to be vandal and tamper resistant, and they have to be designed in a way that supports revenue collection and allows for encryption in order to do debit and credit card transactions. And then the other requirement is that we have to satisfy all of local regulations. Utilities come into play only if we go with conventionally powered devices. One of the benefits of solar is that that would eliminate that requirement. There'd be permitting, of course, and we have to satisfy all the ADA and civil rights requirements. John? Okay, great. Oh, you may have be familiar with a project called NEP, and if you actually go, part of that project involves the turnstiles that we have at the lower level in this building right now. I get this question internally, because folks say, well, is this project going to be compatible with NEP, which is the new electronic payment program that's under consideration? And the answer is yes, that even with NEP, we would still need to serve the unbanked, and folks that are making cash payments are typically, well, and I shouldn't say that, folks that are making cash payments are part of the unbanked. So we would need the ability to support that group of our customers or riders, and so this device would certainly do that. So the marketplace, what we're looking at. As I mentioned, we're looking at parking pay station vendors, again, because they have experience with solar. They have smaller footprints. They've got the experience working outdoors. They have less experience working with smart cards, but that, but we're thinking that that's more of a technical issue that can be readily overcome. We're also looking at the traditional ticket vending machine vendors. They would be removing the ticket printer part of their devices to meet our needs. They would need electric service, which is a significant hurdle, and they have larger footprints, and typically they are more expensive than the parking pay stations, and that's a manufacturing factor. If you think about it, there are, within the city right now, there's like 600 parking pay stations. There are not that many ticket vending machines used for transit in general, and so we get the, with the parking pay station vendors, we get the economies of scale, and they have the ability then to lower their costs for us. Next. So that brings us to where are we thinking of sticking these devices. We are going for lines with high smart chip air value activity and lines with on-time considerations. We're also considering the regional distribution needs, and we're also looking at metro bus stations, which is another way of saying bus bays at metro rail stations. We're looking at an initial quantity of 100 to start with an option for 100 more.
John?
And so for the 100 locations that fit that criteria, they fall on this map. And so you can see that it's pretty much most of those locations are going to be within the district along the border between the northwest and northeast side and the northeast and southeast sides. A few others scattered in on the Virginia side of the ledger, and a few in Montgomery County at this point. That's where the data is pointing us at the moment, but we are very interested in getting feedback. This is not in stone by any stretch of the imagination, and that's part of why I'm here tonight, is to get more feedback on locations that we should be considering. Okay, so what are the challenges that we're facing with this project? Integration with NextFair, which is this back-end system that you are communicating with, whether you realize it or not, that the smart cards are communicating with, the smart chip and Strom cards. That's definitely a challenge. We are also looking at solar versus electric, and for all the reasons indicated, it's to put in a solar device, essentially, if I've got a piece of sidewalk there that's in reasonably good shape and level, then we're talking about epoxying some anchor bolts in, and I put the machine on top of it, and we're done. If we're looking at a conventionally powered device, then I have to find a power source. We have to do trenching. Depending on the utility, we may have to have a meter similar to the glass meter on the for your house would have to be there. It's definitely more challenging if we go down the conventional power route. Other challenges, as you saw from the earlier pictures, we have limited street space, so we have to consider that. We will have multiple jurisdictions, and so we have all the permitting for each jurisdiction that we would have to go through to actually put one of these in the public space. Security and revenue collection are also issues. Right now, all of our revenue collection is really through the rail system, and we have a very secure process for that. This would be something that would be a little bit new to us because we'd have to go off property to collect the money from these devices. But we certainly have our colleagues in DDOT and other location, other government, city governments that have experience working with parking pay stations, and we will be sure to talk to them and have been talking to them to get their advice on the best way to go with that. Last but not least would be utilization, and this is the hardest thing to predict because the intention is to continue to allow riders to add value at the fare box even if we have an off-board loading device at that stop. So what we need to be thinking about are how we would incent riders to actually utilize the off-board loading devices, and that's actually, if we go to the next slide, that is, in addition to the location feedback, that's one of the items I'd love to get feedback from this group on in terms of how we might market it, how we might encourage riders to take advantage of it, and then also get feedback from you in terms of what you see as the benefits of having such a device out there. So with that, I'll stop talking and take any questions you might have.
Thank you.
Okay. Why don't you come to the table so we can just see you there. And we'll start with our public comment period. And I'll just remind everybody, RAC members included, you know, I think this is an area where we can have a lot of very concrete feedback. And so I just encourage people to be as sort of concrete about it as in terms of what you want. And I also encourage people to, you know, if you have a list like I do of things that I want to suggest, email is also an option. So maybe let's try to keep it to one sort of main suggestion per person, because he actually has to leave at 7:15. So in order to get through everybody, let's just keep it as brief as we can. All right, so Kurt, you want to start us off?
Yeah, I am. Sorry, my name is Kurt Rashke. To the extent that, you may end up going with sort of a more traditional transit TVM product, would you be open to some of the ones that can vend a limited-use contactless smart card and then consider, say, selling a one-day or a seven-day bus pass out of those? I mean, it just it opens up some opportunities for people who aren't walking up to the machine with a smart trip card already in hand, but they've got, you know, a $20 bill or what have you, or maybe they have a card. You know, it's the sort of thing that it gives you the ability to continue to capture revenue in a slightly different way. And then I know you didn't highlight the pie chart on your last slide, but I was really surprised to see that market penetration for the MyFare cards is at 25% already. I mean, that's just astounding to me. I didn't think they turned over that fast. I figured the go cards were going to last forever, but anyway.
Last but not least, okay, thank you. When you're dealing with solar power, which we prefer to do, it's green and it has all the other advantages, power consumption becomes a huge issue. And so the more you layer on that, the less likely the machine is going to perform well. And so that's the other factor for us.
Thank you. Chris.
Hi, I'm Chris Barnes. I'm known as Fix Ramada in some circles. First of all, thank you very much for the presentation, and I'm happy to see that Metro is moving towards this, and I hope it coincides with what we're seeing with the technology with the new fare gates. In your presentation, you mentioned a lot about security in terms of basically protecting your money, but I didn't hear much about protecting the riders who are going to be dealing with cash transactions and sometimes a low-light condition. How does Metro plan to protect the rider in these situations on, I'm guessing, basically Metro property in most of the cases?
In the actually, most of the cases, it won't be Metro property. It'll be
in D.C. is DDOT, but in other locations
right,
it is.
Right, I mean, so let's be, there were not that many rail locations that made the list, at least the first cut. The only thing I can respond to is it would be similar to your work. You're at a parking pay station. You have to make your own decision about whether or not you're in a safe and comfortable area where you want to use that device, and it would be the same here. You have to make your own personal decision. Obviously, we don't have officers manning each of the shelters in today's world, and we would not anticipate doing that in the future. It would pretty much kill the project from a cost-benefit perspective.
So you're saying customer beware and Metro denies any liability in those cases?
I'm saying customers should use good judgment about when they reach for their billfold, as they would in any circumstance at any location, whether it be us or any retailer.
Okay, thank you.
Sir.
Hi, I'm Drew. I thought Metro was wanting to wean everyone off the smart card and do pay through their phones. How is this going to affect your project?
Sure.
And do you see, I mean, 100 stations, I mean, if they're trying to move everyone over, is that going to affect you as, you know, limit the number of stations, or are these hundreds set in stone?
To answer your question, that was the reference I made to the NEP project. So even with NEP, for NEP to work, you have to have a contactless credit or debit card. And not everyone who rides our system will have that type of a card. So you'll still need some type of vehicle for the unbanked to utilize our services. And so given that, we're anticipating that these devices will service that market, and these devices can be adapted once, if and when a contract is awarded to do the new electronic payment program. These devices have open technology, so we would be able to adapt them to that process, whatever it may be, because we do know that that process would involve open technology.
Any other public comments? All right, seeing none, I'm just going to go around here. You don't have to put the things up here. So top suggestions. Carol? Patrick? Okay. And Sherry?
Still rethink it a little bit more. The gentleman made the public comment about the high crime, low income areas and having these fare devices. I think you need to work with your contractors. Like the CVS and the Giants, I always find it actually more painful for the consumer, me, to buy a fare card at Giant, and why don't we have these standing devices at CVS and Giant to make it a little easier, because you have to get in line with everyone else to add money to your Smart Trip. I get on at the Rhode Island Avenue station, there's a CVS, and people still put money. You add a station and a CVS, and they're loading the card on the bus. Mm-hmm. And so that just tells me that the CVS is really is a pain to put money on your car. So just rethink the areas. And okay, even at Benning Road, which is a horrible stop, by the way, you have stores right there. Why we can't put a box right in there? There's a D.C. lottery machine in every store in D.C. practically. Let Metro contract. Thank you.
Okay. Mary Ann?
My thought was more around evaluation. I don't know quite the data that you get, but could you do something that is either looking at numbers or percent of cash on buses before and after you put it in, and you see is there a change or not? And
absolutely,
assuming some things like that you'd be looking at. And perhaps some cash overall on all lines would look to see if you're having any success in changing behavior.
Absolutely. We would definitely do before and after analysis using the farebox data.
And going to what she just said, there may also be something around, I hate to call it satisfaction, but usefulness to folks before and after, that would also get to the point of why do people either use it or not use it.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So thank you. Obviously, this project is like way down the road. And I had a couple of questions. One was, I was wondering if you'd actually talk to people who use the fare card and ask them why they loaded on the bus. Might have actually found something interesting. And second, you have Metro requirements, but I didn't see a set of, like, rider requirements. Seems like it would be a good idea to make sure it's going to be really rider-friendly. And the third thing was, it would seem to me that I don't understand why Metro doesn't partner with way more stores, outlets to do this so that people can go just about anywhere and upload, since, you know, you're so limited now with Safeway and CVS
and Giant,
I mean, or whatever. So, I mean, it seems to me like it would be a lot cheaper to partner with, like, lots of places than it would be to, like, set these out all over the place. I mean, I think it's an obvious idea, but it doesn't seem like some of the core basic things have been. And maybe you did all these things, but I don't know.
Well, I will say that one of the reasons why he's here is to get our feedback as riders. So if you have any other sort of concrete suggestions about what can make this more rider friendly, that's what he's here to hear.
Well, I mean, I think part of making it rider friendly is to sit there on a bus and everyone who comes by and does it say, "How come you did that?"
Right. But we represent riders, and
sure, but
that's what he's here to hear from us. So if you have concrete suggestions,
well, I just made two. I don't know if you're paying attention.
Yeah, I am.
All
Let me, to your point about putting the CPOSs in, what we call CPOS, the devices and the CVSs and the Safeways and Giants, and to Ms. Washington's point, I could show you another map that shows how far away the CPOSs or the retailers are from the bus stops that we're considering, and some are a reasonable distance away, but some are, to your point, right on top of the bus stops. And that was a puzzle to us as well. Why are we seeing such low utilization of the devices at the retailers when they're, like, right there? I can show you other pictures. They're right across the street. So feedback, like you gave me about, well, now I have to wait in line, it's not quite as convenient, is food for thought for us in terms of how we could, can we make it more convenient to use those devices at the retailers as opposed to just putting more of them out there, although that is something that is under consideration as well.
Candace?
So feedback on that would be helpful, definitely.
I guess I saw on this that you're adding a bunch of these stations on 14th Street. And so I think it's a great idea because I do live further away from, like, what you said, a CPOD. And so it makes it very convenient for us to just walk up to the bus stop and while at the bus stop waiting for the bus, actually load our card because it does slow down, for example, the 14th Street bus when people are getting on and every other person is adding money to their card. Mm-hmm. I think that maybe the reason that people don't go into CVS, like let's say you're at 14th and Irving, mm-hmm. people don't go into that CVS because, one, they don't remember that it's there, or two, they're running for the bus. I would say maybe the best option to remind people that it's there is maybe even just to put up a sign at the bus stop and say, CVS, right mm-hmm. across the street, you can add money to your fare card. But it's also a hassle once you get into the CVS because if you don't have the proper personnel, like a manager or something like that, then you have to wait around for the manager. If the manager is doing something else, then it could be another 5 to 10 minutes. If it's going to be in a CVS, I feel like it should be its own standalone thing, like you were saying earlier. So I think that it's a great idea for, like, these new stations are good for, like, upper Northwest where you don't have a CVS. But if you're already, like, if you're at 14th and Irving, it should just be inside the CVS where people can easily go and load it up. And just a simple sign at the bus station saying right across the street, you can, you know, load your fare card would make things easy for people.
So a little marketing combined with self-service would make it go better.
Yeah.
Okay.
Patrick?
Mr. Ventura, thank you very much for joining us today. There were a couple things, two things that I want to bring up real quick. The first, Chris mentioned it, is the safety aspect of it. And my initial reaction to that is, you know, I would look at it, I guess, much in the same way as a street front ATM. You know, you're still handling cash. The difference there, though, is that most ATMs either have a fisheye mirror that you can see what's behind you or they have a video camera. Mm-hmm. Now, I realize that camera surveillance is going to jack up your investment mm-hmm. considerably. But I guess the first part of my question is, has there been any consideration to that type of a safety monitoring? And then my second thing is somewhat separate. So why don't I give you a chance to get at that first?
It has been discussed, but it was not. In effect, we went down the path of it. It's not a very likely option because, we did the comparison to the ATM style device as well. But the way we were looking at it was, it's more akin to a parking pay station. And those devices don't have that type of security on them. It's not as if you're withdrawing a large amount of cash from the machine. It's you're putting cash in, and you also have the option of doing debit or credit. So you don't even have to pull out cash if you avail yourself of that option. So when, again, balancing it, of course, that's where we're at the moment. That doesn't mean that, and again, based on the feedback, that we can't take another look at that to see if that's a prevalent concern, what we might be able to do to address that type of scenario. But the discussion has been more along the lines of that, you know, it's really more like a parking pay station. We're not talking about a large sum of money that a person would be putting into the device. At least we don't anticipate that. And so we were thinking the security risk would not be as great as it would be at an unattended ATM.
Okay. Thank you. My next question is actually a little bit more of a suggestion. It seemed like you had, you know, you had broken it down by bus stops and by rail, by the bus bays at rail stations. And the thought process is that you also had that the initial order was going to be for 100 with the option then to purchase 100 more units as pending success. So it would seem that there is the desire to reach as many folks with this as possible. My question is, if there are already smart trip machines at the rail stations, doesn't it make more sense to identify, say you had half dozen or a dozen rail stations that you were going to put these things in? Wouldn't you want to identify a half dozen or a dozen more bus stations that you could put more at and then sacrifice the rail stations because they already have the ability to load a smart trip card there? That's, like I said, it's just more of a suggestion than anything
else. And then that has been a topic that's been under considerable discussion. Including in terms of the process, to give you an idea too, if a rail station is what is actually the terminus of a bus line, then that it makes it less likely that we'd want to put a device there, to your point, because a bus could be sitting there for a number of minutes before it starts its scheduled run. And so if you have an added value transaction during that time span, I guess in a sense, big deal, right? It doesn't really impair the bus's on-time performance. But at the same time, yeah, to your point, there are the it's trying to gauge the human behavior aspect of this, because we have in the rail stations you can add value, and yet people don't do that. And so, what is it from a human behavior perspective that's preventing that from happening? And are there other things we could do to encourage folks to take advantage of that and not tie up the bus? So yes, but we've definitely had these discussions.
Thank you, Pat.
For me, I'm thinking that some of the riders just don't know the impact resulting in using the fare machine there on the bus. So I'm thinking signage that says, like, do you know that if you use this fare card, you're slowing down the bus by however many minutes, or do you know that, you know, you're not getting out to wherever on time because you're using it here. Go wherever and use it, you know, like that. So signage, I think they just don't know. They just don't realize that the impact that they cause by using that fare card on the bus.
No, that's an excellent point. And that was actually going to be one of my questions for you. How far... I mean, to some extent, we could do something that creates, if you will, a peer pressure. So do you know, not only from your perspective, but you're inconveniencing your passengers? I mean, I could envision a marketing campaign where someone's adding value at the fare box and five other people are standing outside in the rain waiting to board the bus. To create that type of awareness that you're, you know, to basically to be courteous to your fellow passengers and think ahead. This is my focus group, so to speak. Is that something that would?
We have talked a little bit in the past about the hectoring nanny state problem that Metro has.
Okay.
So you would have to be mindful of that, but it is something that we've discussed a lot here. I mean, there are already announcements on the bus that say it's not just on the bus. Go to CVS and Giant, blah blah blah. But
right. Maybe
it's just a twist in the way that it's marketed. Yeah, please.
Like I said earlier, I think it's easy for people if they live next to a CVS. Uh-huh. But if you're waking up in the morning and you live in, let's say, Upper Northwest, and there's not a CVS a block or two away, the issue isn't that you just don't know, is that you just don't have any other option. So with more options, it would actually speed up the process. So it's not that people, you know, want to add at that bus station. Maybe they just didn't get a chance the day before when they were in downtown or somewhere else. It's just sometimes that's your only option, mm-hmm. and that's the problem right now, is that that's your only option.
Okay.
Frank?
I'm primarily a bus rider, but I also do use the rail, so that's where I add on. But so I was very excited to hear this until the comparison came up to the parking machines. And my experience with parking machines is horrible. they don't work. There's one municipality in Maryland where I have to use the machine. I've gotten six tickets since November that I've had to, you know, call for review on. I don't want to throw out all my complaints, but I do I mentioned it because I think one of the things that would be very important in this is that they have to be very high-quality machines.
Mm-hmm.
That you know, the district has so many parking machines where I've gone and they're broken. And then just secondly, utilization incentives, just the very simple one of making it cheaper, mm-hmm. making it cheaper to use it.
Thank you. Tricia.
I appreciate your being here, first and foremost. And I have to admit that I am one of those persons that pay daily, and I'm going to tell you why.
Okay.
I have lost money on the Smart Trip, and the turnaround time on the refunds for registered cards is not pretty. It has not been pretty. I've done this three times. I refuse to put more than $5 on my Smart Trip card. It may sound cheap, but it's very frustrating when you have your money up there and you can't use it. And there's another demographic that a lot of us are overlooking. A lot of people that use the bus do not have the money every day. That's the population you need to target. I can only speak for the people that I represent the district, but I'm on this, as I said before, because I'm representing primarily east of the river. And a lot of those people, I mean, they have to use the bus, but they don't have that money. Mm-hmm. It's hard to get that money every day, you know, and that may seem strange to some people, but that's a reality. And so when you said parking pay station, I was like, well, a lot of people aren't parking that are using the bus that are paying at that, you know, as it goes on. And it is frustrating. But a lot of people don't have the money. And I would like to piggyback off of what Patrick said about the ATM machine. I don't know how it can be done, but if there's some way that it can be set up somewhere along that line, maybe you can partner with financial institutions. I'm not sure if that's something you may or may not have thought of, to let them pick up some of that cost. Because I'm sure they would benefit from it. That's a thought that you might want to think of, you know. But to me, it's an excellent idea. I don't do it because I'm not going to, I just can't. I just refuse.
To your point, we're actually very sensitive to that issue. And I can tell you, let's see, we evaluated 825,000 add value transactions at the fare box between October of last year through end of January, and 55% of those transactions were $2 or less. So we are that you're absolutely right. That's the group of folks that we really want to. We are intending this to be for
everyone.
And, well, I'll leave it at that, yeah, mm-hmm. for everyone, including the folks that are paying one fare at
right.
a time.
Okay.
And that is, we are very sensitive to that aspect.
So I think this is excellent. That's why I said this is excellent. If somehow this can be done, I think this will benefit all of us,
mm-hmm.
you know, because I'm not cheap. I just get frustrated,
that's
you
true.
Know, and I take the bus because I refuse to stand up. If I'm getting on the second stop, I have to pay $4 and I got to stand up. That bugs me. So I'll just take the 2-hour drive for $1.60. But I'm not going to give the $20 if they're going to eat. You know, my thing is you're eating up my $20 and I have to wait 4 or 5 weeks to get it back. You know, that frustrates me. And my card is registered. But it's not about me. It's that group that just does not have the money.
But you're also mm-hmm. hitting on a point mm-hmm. of being concerned about putting a lot of value on your card if you can't get a resolution for a lost or a missing card.
A quick turnaround time.
Yes, and
reasonable. I guess that's what I mean.
So I'll let me take that back mm-hmm. As well in terms of our customer service. I will mention that along those lines, we've made a number of improvements to our website. To support that function as well, and so I would, I would encourage anyone if, who finds themselves in that situation, if they go to WMATA.com, that that is the best and fastest way to get a turnaround for a replacement of a registered,
okay,
which is the other thing. While I'm here, only about 25% of the folks register their cards, and you really, I would encourage everyone to register their cards in order to protect the balance and avail themselves of the other features available to registered cardholders.
And there are a lot of people that do not know that their cards need to be registered. I know that sounds in crazy, but there's a large group of people.
I believe that. Mm-hmm. As a matter of fact, not with this project, but another project I'm working on, we're working on a campaign around advertising or encouraging folks to register their cards, encouraging folks to take advantage of our auto reload feature,
okay,
as well, which would also go a long way to helping with everything, actually. Where it hits a certain dollar amount and your card automatically replenishes.
Oh, okay.
That can avoid a lot of the issues in terms of, you wouldn't have to go to a CVS, you wouldn't have to use this device if you were on the auto reload program. So there are features there, but I also know that they haven't been, and this point's been made a couple of times, they haven't really been marketed recently. They were marketed when they were first launched, but they haven't been marketed recently, and I am working with our marketing department to improve upon that.
And again, I don't want to hold you up. I think
sure.
This is an excellent, excellent
well, thank
idea.
You.
I really
thank
do.
You.
Lorraine?
Okay, I'll be quick. If you you want us to make suggestions, if
yes.
If you could provide us with a list of where the locations are selected right now, because I mean the
John did send out more detailed maps, actually, because
no,
I had that same suggestion.
Because
well, but they're just to the district.
That's
true.
The thing.
Okay.
I don't,
that's
with
true.
All
you don't
due respect,
represent
I really
district.
Don't.
Yes.
About the district. Okay.
True. Okay.
Then. The other thing is regarding incentives. It was quite a long time ago. Been living here for 30 years using Metro. So, but it used to be that Metro, the biggest incentive was that if you put in $20 on your fare card,
mm-hmm,
it would give you 10%. Add 10%. Of course, with all the budget restrictions, you know, and all the budget problems, that went by the wayside.
Mm-hmm.
That is an incentive that a person that cannot afford is like, well, I'm getting money back. I may try to do it this way.
Mm-hmm.
Just saying.
Sure.
I understand there's a lot of budget, but that would make a big difference.
Okay.
Okay. And that is something that was done a long time ago. It was, at that time, it was to use as an incentive for people to get to use Metro as opposed to using their car to get them off their cars. But I think that would, you know, be a benefit. Another thing is, and a suggestion is, when you get those machines, if you do the solar powered, I know there are some things that are solar powered that when they are covered with 6 inches of snow or whatever, they don't work, okay? So I've been thinking that you're going to have to get some kind of backup power because, you know, if you get 6 inches, and we know that even the roads get paralyzed, so will the machine. I know that some streetlights just don't work, and it's because it has a lot of snow on the top. So think about that. I'm all for going green and solar power, but you have to think of backup. And the other thing is, when you put the instructions, because I've noticed there's a lot of problems in the buses, is that a lot of people that are trying to load in money, they don't speak English. You may have the instructions in English. Try to put them in, you know, at least in Spanish, which, at least in my neighborhood, there's a lot more Spanish speakers, so try to at least be bilingual. If you can have the room to be more, you know, even better. That's about it.
All right. Thank you.
One quick comment on the solar, mm-hmm, to your point. The devices we're looking at actually have batteries in them, and the manufacturers claim that they could go for more than a week and still work in complete darkness. So what's happening essentially is it's the battery that's operating the device, and then it's the sunlight, and it could be even ambient sunlight, is trickle charging the battery. So the likelihood of the device failing should be pretty low, and in fact, the feedback I had from DDOT concerning their solar power parking stations tended to support that manufacturer's claim. So, but it's an excellent point, and it is absolutely something we were concerned about and will test.
Barbara? James?
Just want to make a quick observation about your map here. Very few, if any, locations here are in Prince George's County. I'm sure that's something that you'll rectify as you go through this process. Just wanted to FYI.
Sure.
And Carol did have one.
Yes. Thank you for the presentation. I really am enthused about something that has been suggested here, and that is to maybe give other vendors that are near the bus stops where you have this high, you know, frequency of payment on the bus, an opportunity to compete with the CVSs and Giants. Because what I suspect, I mean, I go to a lot of CVSs, mostly in the district, and, you know, right now they're so involved with their own electronic thing that usually, at least in the CVSs that I go to, the manager is presiding over the electronic so-called self-serve cashing out. And I've seen a lot of CVSs where there's very little attention paid to the, when somebody asks for assistance or to buy a smart trip, they're given short shrift. So I think I would like to see Metro literally go around and draw circles that correlate to the highest frequencies of the onboard payments and the on-time performance impact, and see what vendors are out there who might be interested in doing. For example, 7-Eleven. I live at the Fort Totten Metro, and the 7-Eleven is probably a good bet to have people go in there so they could be loading their smart trip cart. So that's my suggestion. I really think that would be worth pursuing.
Okay. Thank you for the feedback.
And then just finally, sort of rapid fire from me. Please put one of these at the National Cathedral. There are oodles of tourists there that keep the 30s and the N buses for forever. Georgetown, probably same deal. A lot of tourists there. I think not just the unbanked, but tourists also have a problem with this. I'd be interested in knowing the relationship between the upcoming shelter upgrades for some, where we might have automatic arrival information, and having these off-board loaders. When you're talking about power and things like that, it seems to me there'd be a lot of value added for riders if we were to combine these two projects. So just sort of something to think about there.
And I have been in touch with that project manager, by the way.
Okay, good. In terms of reaching the unbanked, you might want to consider putting these sort of machines in check cashing places, because that's where people have the money and are sort of ready to spend it, as it were. You might want to consider, in some locations where space is an issue, some sort of ATM style where it's like in a wall on the side of a building, rather than in a shelter if there's even not even enough room for a shelter, sort of putting it in a wall there. And I was thinking in terms of the marketing aspect, for people who do end up putting their putting value on the card on the bus, have some sort of take one style handout that the driver can give to the person saying, did you know there are other options? And by the way, you know, you're making the buses late or something like that. And then finally, I'm just curious what the relationship is between this project and the Title VI issue.
I'm familiar with Title VI, but I'm not
In terms of, is this getting money from that project, or is this being designed around the goals of that project? Because it seems like there's quite a bit of confluence, actually, in terms of reaching traditionally unbanked and minority populations and what you're trying to do here.
I'm afraid you haven't yet a disadvantage. I mean, I'm very familiar with Title VI, and this project will comply with Title VI.
Sure.
But I'm not, from a funding perspective, I'm not aware of any funding source.
Title VI does not give money. Title VI is a condition of money.
But Metro has grants under Title VI that are for, no? Okay. Forget what
you
I just said.
Comply with Title VI, right. We get grants.
Oh, I see. All right.
we don't get Title VI grants per se.
Anyway, thank you very much.
Oh, my pleasure.
For coming. And I'm sure that we all have actually a lot more suggestions. And I just, you know, please send those on to John.
Please do.
So we can add those to the official record of this.
Okay.
All right.
Thank you very much.
I appreciate it.
Okay.
Next on our agenda is a report from the Budget and Finance Committee. James, you want to enlighten us? It was a while ago, it seems, wasn't it?
Yes. Let me just say that I want to thank the members of the RAC who attended the Budget and Finance Committee meeting. The man's name escapes me, but he gave an excellent presentation on how the budget process works. And I'll talk to the chair about this, whether we'll have a meeting next week. And we do need a chair of this committee, so just want to let you all know that. And thank you very much.
All right, thank you. Safety committee, can someone fill us in Carl's absence? Anyone? Anyone else is there? All right. Operations and communications, actually Karen was out today due to an illness, but
in yes. Carl's absence,
sure.
I was also absent at last month's safety and security subcommittee meeting, but I was made aware that I was elected chair of that subcommittee in my absence. I'm going to be working together with John to provide a more comprehensive update on what we're working on, the work plan that we devised, and I will circulate that by email over the next couple weeks. I would ask, Carl was a wonk. He was great. He knew everything there was to know about procedure and ins and outs and everything, and I would ask for patience as I try to mimic that knowledge base and get up to his speed, or at least towards his speed. But I'm excited about doing it, and I hope that we can do some good things.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Operations and Communications, Barbara, would you?
I have an unofficial report from
please,
that committee.
Please do.
We had our meeting. We had the greatest portion of our last meeting was representatives of the Customer Relations Department who came in. And I did prepare a report last week, but our chair has not had an opportunity yet, apparently, to review it, so wanted to hold up to present it to you tonight. But it was a great exchange. They answered every question we had. It seemed very, very open and good flowing communication. We had some of the data they presented to us. They did it about staffing and hours and the process they use for customer comments and the breakdown on the nature of the calls, how they get them, a lot of information, some surprises, some not. And you'll have to read the report when it comes out to find out more about the specifics, because I want to inspire you to read it when you get it if it's an email. We did come up with some next steps and assembling the feedback from within our committee and then getting this group's feedback, requesting additional data from the customer relations group and developing some recommendations. We did have some preliminary ones, just very preliminary. As they talked, we came up with some ideas. But those, I think, need more attention and more delving into. But it was a very encouraging exchange of information. We had some of the public members that, as I always do, they were very, very helpful in bringing up some issues. So stay tuned.
Okay. Thank you very much. Now we have an item about our public participation process. I will let Carol detail further what this is all about. Basically coming back to something that we had committed to do before.
Thank you. I attended the operations and communications meeting, and one of the items on the agenda was a review of the public participation process, and that is on page 35 of the material in our agenda packet. It's agenda item 9. We had comments from the public who were there and comments from the committee, and on the basis of that, the following revisions were made, and I believe they're underlined. We started this public participation process, as I recall, like in the spring of 2012. We reviewed and updated in October, and it's called for review 6 months later. We were a little over that time, but that's what caused it. So basically the changes that were made and that are proposed for approval by the full REC are these, that the procedures were amended to make it clear that it applies to standing committee meetings as well as the full meeting of the REC. That the time frame for the public to submit comments was changed in two ways. We had talked about a Tuesday before the Wednesday, but I took that language was deleted, so we're not bound by a specific date or day of a meeting. And then, and this was actually a suggestion made by one of our public commenters, that instead of a review every 6 months, because we've been sort of living under this process for a while, that we could have go for an annual review. So with that, I would like to move that we approve the changes to the process for public participation in meetings as shown on pages 35 and 36 of our agenda packet.
Is there a second?
Second.
Second.
Okay.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Is there any debate on this? Oh, yes, public comment. Any? Well, that was ironic, wasn't it?
I said this in that subcommittee, but I wanted to make sure everyone heard me. Thank you. And I mean that from the bottom of my heart. The atmosphere has changed over the last year in here. And as one of the few folks who show up from the public, I want to say that I really appreciate your willingness to listen to us and include us more in these meetings and provide more opportunities for us to speak. So, again, just thank you. That's it. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Any others? Kurt?
I wanted to second what Chris said, and I guess I'm defeating the purpose of the committees because I'm going to say the same thing I said in the committee, but something very similar. You know, the public comment process has been working well. It's been a sea change. I mean, this is actually the 30th consecutive monthly meeting of the RAC I've attended. And I can tell you that the atmosphere in early 2011 was decidedly more chilly. Certainly there's been some turnover on the RAC, and that has helped considerably. You know, you're a great group of people to work with, I would say. You know, certainly you really do keep the riders in mind, and I appreciate that, and I know we all appreciate that. But, you know, but having sort of the bureaucratic framework to actually be able to speak to people during the meeting, that helps considerably. So, you know, I'll reiterate my comment from the committee meeting. It's worked very well. You know, I say that from the public perspective and certainly from speaking to some of you. It seems like it's worked very well for the RAC as well. So, thank you.
Thank you. Right,
thank you. Anyone else? Any other public comments? All right. Is there any debate on this? Or other motions? Sir.
So need to put in agenda approval, minutes approval as well?
We had actually discussed that. That was never changed from an early rendition of this. But it was sort of agreed, I think, informally, although it never resulted in a written change, that the public had a right to comment on the agenda items, not approval of the agenda, but had a right to comment on the agenda items. In other words, the public comment period at the beginning of the meeting is for non-agenda items, but they did have a right to comment on the agenda itself. You know, so that was the reason why that language was changed.
Got it. So do you want to offer, are you offering an amendment or?
Can I just ask one question?
Yes.
What changed? I don't know what the original procedure was.
The parts that are underlined are the parts.
There's nothing underlined.
Yeah, just a couple things.
It's very few things.
The first,
it's the very, very top.
First line and the last.
Right.
And the last part. That's it.
Where?
I think the person who started put it very well. It's a bureaucratic process and it's a bureaucratic change, but it does make a difference in that it's clear that the public can has the same ability to participate at the standing committee meetings as at the full RAC meeting. I mean, I think that's the essence. And the second point was we now can review this annually as opposed to reviewing it every six
right.
months.
We set ourselves up for this in saying before that we had to do it every 6 months. So that's why we're reconsidering this now. Any other debate? Or motions, for that matter? Thank you. All right, we'll now vote on any debate on this measure. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Any abstentions? Thank you. All right, we'll proceed directly to a vote. All in favor of the motion as stated, which is to accept what's on page 35 and 36 of our packets as amended. All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Any abstentions? All right, the motion carries. Thank you very much. Finally, or soon to finally, RAC membership. We've had a few people leave us, some for sort of technical reasons, others for sort of attendance reasons. So we're going to have a couple of openings primarily on the DC side, and we're going to look to get those filled as soon as possible, obviously, especially because there's sort of one jurisdiction is more impacted by the other than the others. So just sort of an update there that we're going to try and get those filled as soon as possible. Moving on to number 11, the July meeting date as scheduled as the first Wednesday of the month happens to fall on the Friday, July 3rd, which is sort of before the July 4th holiday, and probably a lot of people want to make plans for that neck of the woods. So the thought was that we're going to bump next month's meeting back 1 week, so it would be the 10th, I believe, correct? So, Carol, would you care to make that motion just for the record?
Yes. I move that the July meeting be moved from July 3rd to July 10th.
Thank you. We have a second as well. Any debate on this?
That will conflict with the Safety and Security Subcommittee meeting.
For July.
Which, will happen. That's kind of regularly the second.
I think we discovered that that's a five-week month, correct? So we would just bump all the committee meetings 1 week as well, and they would still fit within that month?
Okay. That's certainly fine. Can I reserve the right to get with the members of my committee and see if we can't wedge it in to that same meeting?
Yes.
All right. Great.
Any other debate?
I'm just here, right, because it also affects the other committee that meets on the 3rd. So then the meetings would be instead of the 10th and 17th, it would be on the 17th and 24th?
Correct. Correct. Any other debate? All right. I'm just going to bring this one to a vote. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Just put the extensions. All right. Thank you very much. Before we go to open mic, I just have two sort of administrative items. One is we have a map over there for Carl. It's our tradition that when you leave the RAC after a certain time in service that we all sign an official Metro map for you. So please go over there and say something nice for Carl. He will be still participating in these meetings. He's going to try and take as active a role as possible, but he was not able to continue as a full RAC member. So please go ahead and do that. I'll remind everybody that after this, we're going to be going downstairs for the Fairgate demonstration, where they are sort of putting together a focus group for us, and it is unfortunately just for us as RAC members. The public, they're going to be doing some separate things for that, so they're trying to separate out the two, and for that reason, we're just going to be going down as the RAC. Third, I just want to give people an update on the idea of the customer service pledge. This is something we've been talking about both here in the full RAC and in some of the committees. Lest you think that we are not doing anything about this, we are doing something about this. I've been in contact with Tom Downs, the chairman of the board, about this, and it's been mentioned in the board's executive committee already. We are still discussing the process for how that would happen and sort of where the responsibilities lie between the RAC and the board. So I was hoping to have something for you by this meeting. Unfortunately, due to various scheduling issues, I do not. But by July, I certainly hope to have something and maybe hopefully a motion of some kind in terms of tasking the committees or getting us involved in this a little more, because I definitely want to move that forward. All right. So with that, I will open it up for open mic. Anybody have any thoughts? Public commenters, us?
I guess this has to be said because this happened the last time with, oh goodness, what was it? It was the 7,000 series seats. WMATA said they were doing quote unquote focus groups to have people sit in seating samples for the 7,000 series. And it's like, I don't know who actually sat in those seats, but it seemed to be they've got a very limited definition of public. And then when they actually had, well, and then you all got to see the 7,000 series soft mock-up. I don't know if you got to see the hard mock-up when it was here before this. Okay, yeah, you all saw the hard mock-up. They invited one blogger, Matt Johnson of Greater Greater Washington, on and on and on and on. It's the kind of thing where some of us who would really like to evangelize this transit authority and, you know, there comes a point where we're like, you know, I mean, Chris, really, you should watch, like, one day of Chris's life on Twitter. I mean, I'm sorry, but he doesn't sleep. He doesn't eat. He takes the iPad in the shower with him. I'm joking. But, I mean, seriously, and there are people who have made it very clear that they really do get more information about WMATA from him than, and we don't get, you know, there are transit authorities that do things to give back to the community for, frankly, just for evangelizing. You know, they say, hey, we want to take our most dedicated riders and do something nice for them. And I've never gotten that sort of sense from WMATA. It's always been a door slammed in our face. And here's another case where, you know, obviously the net procurement, I mean, there are rules having to do with procurements, and so there are certain things they can't say to the public, period. But it's like, when the 7,000 series hard mock-up was here, they could have brought 5 or 10 of us out to take a look at it. If they could get you all out there, they could have rounded up some folks and said, we want to generate goodwill with the community. This is not a transit authority that grasps the concept of goodwill.
In their defense, since you guys never leave this room, I mean, you have access. You can just sort of go around the corner. Right? I was joking with them when they came in that they were already here. It was like 6 o'clock. Nobody else in the room. It's like they never left. Okay. Sir.
So, I promised I wouldn't bring this up, but I'm breaking my own promise. I filed a PARP with WMATA, and I want to let you guys know why and what it's about. The request for information is to find out who WMATA has blocked on Twitter, and I filed it because I am now one of those people that WMATA has blocked. I think, first of all, if I remove myself from the situation, no government agency should be blocking paying riders or taxpayers from receiving information. I don't know if this is something the RAC cares to look at or get involved with, but I did want to let you know that that's what's going on. And when or if I get the information that I've requested, I'll be sure to pass it on to RAC comments. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Anyone else? I think I saw a hand over there.
I and I had read about the new short rail pass that I can get on my smart trip. So I did this. Of course, much to my chagrin, it doesn't cover buses, which kind of defeats the entire purpose of having a transit pass. As someone who I worked for the Strap Hangers campaign in New York, and I had my monthly card and whatever, and I rode, I don't know how many hundreds of miles in New York for a fraction of what it would cost on WMATA just for a short trip rail pass for a month. It just seems crazy that I couldn't have a little goodwill and a little, you know, a 1 mile bus trip for, you know, maybe $5 more or something.
All right. Thank you. Patrick.
But I just wanted to take a second and piggyback off of what Chris is talking about. You know, as we kind of move in the direction of new media and we move in the direction of being more open and encouraging public comments and public involvement in these meetings, social media is going to be a part of that. It's going to be a part of that, however we choose to interact with it. The Twitter sphere, the Twitterers that are Metro detractors and Metro critics, there are things that they say that we don't agree with. There are things that they say that potentially we feel are not very civil or very constructive, but there's also things that they say that are perhaps things that we were thinking but don't want to say ourselves. The whole reason I'm new, so take this all with a grain of salt, but I feel like the whole reason we're here is to encourage a dialogue, whether that's a dialogue between the public and the RAC or a dialogue between the RAC and the board, or some sort of combination of those three things. Nothing works if we don't foster that dialogue. And so, you know, I'm on Twitter. I'm not as on as much as maybe I'd like or as much as some other folks are, but you don't get anywhere by cutting one party off in the conversation, even if that's something that you don't agree with. There's still ideas out there, and I think we stand to gain a lot by looking at those ideas. And so that's something that, you know, I don't agree with everything that comes out of Chris's Twitter feed, but I'm not gonna stop listening because I don't agree with it. And that was something that surprised me a little bit. And so I appreciate what you're saying. And you know, it's something that as long as we keep the conversation going, I think we're moving in the right direction.
Okay, thank you. Anything else for the open mic? Yes.
One thing I think Metro needs to do, especially for the tourists, is tell them that stations close between 11 and 12, not just midnight. Went to the Nats-Tigers game earlier last month. There was a rain delay. I can't describe I don't have the word to describe the look on this couple's face from Michigan when I told them the Metro closes at Nats Park at like 11:20 or 11:30. The bewilderment was, what do you mean it closes? Because they had a hotel up near DuPont, and they're at Nats Park. The game was delayed, and I'm from Michigan, so I felt comfortable telling them that why everyone's leaving at 10:50. First of all, it's embarrassing, and there was a discussion back in the playoffs because the game started 8, not 7. It's embarrassing to see a stadium fill out in the seventh inning of a delayed game because Metro says it's time to go home. And something has to be done because apparently we're the nation's capital, we're an international city, and international cities do not close at 11:20 at night on a Thursday. They just don't. And I'm sure the businesses downtown would appreciate longer hours. I know there's trying to be a thriving nightclub atmosphere downtown with the Hamilton and a bunch of other bars and all that mess. And Metro is stunning the growth of the city, and it's a shame and it's embarrassing. And I wish I had a picture to show you this guy's face. It was just like, Oh, I guess we should go then. So that's where I'm going to leave that at.
I believe this has been raised in terms of who will pay for this, and that the Nationals have refused to pay for it. So
they should pay for it. They're a public transportation entity that should run when people need it.
Right. I mean, there's a cost benefit debate that's already happened on that score.
$100,000 an hour, according to them.
Because you have to run the whole.
Baseball season, there's 81 home days. Figure a third of them are day games. Figure it out from there.
Right. Well, we should talk about this later. There are budgetary consequences to such things. Anyway, any more, Barbara?
Yeah, this is sort of a question. I know we've talked at some various times about brainstorming Blue Line. What can we do for the Blue Line? What would the Blue Line people ever think is some sort of condolences for losing the service that they're accustomed to when the Silver Line opens? And I think we have something planned or in the works, but I can't remember
next
what.
Next meeting?
Okay, we're going to talk about it then.
Yes.
All right. We want them to think about anything before
then?
I sent
you the letter like last week.
Okay.
It's in your email box already.
Okay, well, that's
we will,
a full
we will
hour
talk
days
about this
are getting
next
me.
Sure.
So I'd just like to add one thing. On Monday, there was a switch failure at Vienna. The train I rode from Foggy Bottom to Vienna took about an hour and 45 minutes, and there was not one announcement on the train why it was going so slowly.
Mary Ann?
I guess it's, I wasn't on any train, but I keep seeing once or twice, it seems, a week that outside of Silver Spring there is another signal problem. And given all the work that's being done and how that's one of the stations that's closed most weekends, that seems it would be helpful to have some idea why the same problem comes up multiple times and may or may not be in process of getting fixed.
Thanks. Anything else?
Can I add just a word?
Sure.
I did look 5 times in the month of May. There was a problem at Silver Spring that was tracked with either signal or slither somehow. 5 times. I don't measure it. I'm out of turn by saying this, but I'd be very curious to know how many of the problems in Silver Spring relate back to the Great Flood of 2004, in which the train control room was under several feet of water. Now, the two new prefab buildings there at Silver Spring replaced the old train control room that was inundated. So the question is, are the failures that we're seeing now other components that were also inundated, or is it teething pains from the new train control room, et cetera? Nobody knows. It'd be great to know.
It's a good question. We can maybe talk a little more about following up on that offline. Okay. Seeing none, we're about ready to go down to our Fairgate demonstration. Meeting adjourned.